Thank you. So this subject is huge. When I agreed, Harferti asked me and I agreed to do this, I had some idea how huge it is, but it's actually bigger than that. So in last 30 years, there have been more than 40,000 papers in low-dimensional electron systems. Okay, and the reason is that it's one of those things, subjects which go all the way from very abstract things like topological quantum computation to very applied subjects like high-speed transistors. They're all based on two-dimensional electron system. So what I'm going to do is, obviously I cannot talk about even what is going on in this program, but I'm going to try to highlight a few topics and why the subjects are interesting. So let me start by talking about what are they. Actually, I'll tell you the four things that I will discuss. What are they? What are low-dimensional electron systems? And in the process, I'll tell you what they are not. For example, high TC materials, qubits, are not low-dimensional electron systems from the context of our program, and I'll explain to you why. Two, I'll talk about some properties and characteristics of low-dimensional systems. Some, I mean, this is obviously just some very broad ones. Three, I have to talk about quantum Hall effects, since that's kind of brought it into the mainstream of theoretical physics at least. And four, then I'm going to talk about graphene, which is in some sense the ultimate low-dimensional system. Now, when I say low-dimensional, I'll be mostly talking about two-dimensional system. The reason is, so mostly I'll be talking about two-dimensional system. Reason is that once you go from 3 to 2, the way you go from 2 to 1 and 1 to 0 are basically the same, and most of the work has been done on two-dimensional system. So let me tell you all the materials, well, many of the materials, many of the buzzwords which are associated with these two-dimensional systems, because I'm sure you have heard at least some of those words. So first is MOSFETs. So if you have any kind of computer, you are carrying two-dimensional system in it, because metal oxide semiconductor, this is where the two-dimensional system was originally discovered in 1965. Then heterostructures. So if you have cell phones, it's filled with gallium arsenide heterostructures. So this is gallium arsenide. I'm going to explain what they are, but first I want to write down the names of the system. And if you have cell phones, they have these high mobility transistors, which are made of gallium arsenide and aluminum gallium arsenide sandwich. That's a two-dimensional system. Then there are quantum wells, which are also made of gallium arsenide or other semiconductor. And there are quantum wires, one-dimensional system made out of them. Quantum dots, which are zero-dimensional system made out of them. Superlattices. And one curious system, which is different, all of these are semiconductors. This is silicon, and these are mostly these are all 3-5 materials from the compound semiconductor from the third group and the fifth group of the periodic table, mostly gallium arsenide based. Okay, but there is a curious system which is different from this. That's electrons on the surface of liquid helium, bound by image potential. This is probably the cleanest two-dimensional system. It's also a classical two-dimensional system. Now, what I will not talk about, which are huge subjects on there, and graphene, of course, are nanotubes, which apparently is the largest single topic in all of physics, according to physics world, nanotubes and organic low-dimensional systems, 1D organics. The reason I'm not going to talk about them is that they're very interesting, but in this program, they don't feature prominently, and they're huge subjects unto their own, so I'm not going to talk about them at all with no apology. So what is a two-dimensional? Let me start by saying what is a two-dimensional system. A two-dimensional system is a system whose single particle wave function. Okay, write it in this manner, is given by this sort of form. It has e to the power ikr. So I'm writing the wave function, single particle wave function, in strictly, but these are bound states. So what you're doing is you're applying some kind of potential in z direction, electric field in z direction. So let's say that somehow you can make this potential in life, and you have an electron gas, some kind of metal, which is purely gallium, completely continuum, and you just apply a confinement potential in z direction. What's going to happen? Well, electrons will get confined here, and they will form, these states. if you are now, your Fermi level is right here, this is a two-dimensional electron system, because the electron motion is quantized in z direction. There is dynamics is completely frozen in z direction. So if you want to talk about mass, you cannot talk about a mass in z direction. That mass is infinite. The electron doesn't move at all. Okay? So whenever you have something like this, that's called a two-dimensional electron system. So this is our definition of two-dimensional electron system, this. Now, of course, this definition will apply to anything. If I take a metal bar, I can say, well, it has some confinement potential over a centimeter or something like that. There will be such things called subbands. But with metal, you cannot make a two-dimensional system. Why? Well, the thinnest metal film you can have is 5 angstrom, maybe 2 angstrom. If you just calculate how many levels there will be occupied, there'll be, even in the thinnest metal film, there's going to be of the order of hundreds. Okay? So, which basically means is that if you take a thin metal film, you'll have these levels, but so many levels will be occupied that you're better off thinking of it as a three-dimensional system, maybe with some anisotropy rather than a two-dimensional system. Okay? So you cannot make this thing in a metal. So what do you go? What do you need to do this? Well, it's obvious what you need. You need this confinement size, let me call that A, to be of the order of the Fermi wavelength of your system. Because if that is of the order of Fermi wavelength, then you have a quantum confinement in that direction. So what is the typical Fermi wavelength in a metal? Well, solid state physicists know these numbers right away. They're of the order of 1 angstrom. That means if you want a metal film to show this two-dimensional confinement, if you want a low-dimensional electron system out of metals, you have to make the film less than 1 angstrom, which is a meaningless number. So, and even if it's 10 angstrom, you have about 100 subbands occupied. So it's not two-dimensional, okay? So what do you go then? Well, it's obvious what you need. You know that this Fermi wavelength goes as density cube. This is goes as density cube. So you need something which has very low density. Now, what is the size of these energy levels? Because you want that to be small also. Size of this energy level, just on dimensional ground, forgetting all the pi, factor of pi and so on, is 1 over ma square, right? Mass. So you want this to be large, and you want the Fermi energy to be small. So obviously what you want is large m and small density, because small density means large wavelength. So those materials, of course, are the favorite materials of industry. They're called semiconductors. Because in semiconductor, you can have very low density. Ordinary metal will have n of the order of 10 to the power 23 per cubic centimeter, right? Avogadro's number. That's the number of electrons you have in an ordinary metal, piece of metal. In semiconductor, you can have this number since they're doped, so this is metal. In semiconductor, this number could vary anything from 10 to the power 15 to 10 to the power 19 per cubic centimeter. So you get a factor of 100 because cube root comes in from here. Okay? Mass also, in metals, electron mass is basically of the order of 1. Well, you know, I'm comparing with free electron mass. But in semiconductor, like in gallium arsenide, for example, M gallium arsenide is over M0 is of the order of 0.07. So you're getting another factor of 20 from here. So this factor of 20, this factor of 100 gives you a factor of 2,000, and that's what makes semiconductors two-dimensional. So now when you apply confinement potential, you can have a situation where only this lowest level is occupied. What that means is that on a single particle level, the electron's energy is given by some EI of k, where this k is a two-dimensional wave vector parallel to the plane, given by some EI, where EI as this quantized level for z motion, plus h bar squared k squared over 2m. M in general could depend on the index. And if only one level is occupied, we call this two-dimensional, because its motion is completely quantum mechanically frozen to be in this one level. There is no dynamics in z direction at all. Yes?
Is gallium arsenide optimal or maximal, or is it typical?
Gallium arsenide is typical and also optimal. People have been working on it for 29 years. It was first made in 1980. It's typical and optimal. Most of the work now is in gallium arsenide.
So we can't do better than 0.07?
Oh, no, you can do much better than 0.07. You can do 0.01 without any problem, indium arsenide, but the material is not as good. You run into problem of non-parabolic and other things that we don't want. Okay. So the wave function, again, I'm talking about just one electron physics here, is given by, you know, k and z goes as e to the power I k r, where k and r both two-dimensional vector parallel to the two-dimensional plane, and then you have something like this. So almost all the simple potentials that you have in an undergraduate quantum mechanical textbook actually has been applied in real systems. It's quite amazing. So what are the typical things you'll have? So this is a square well. You can make that very easily by having a sandwich of gallium arsenide. Now, gallium arsenide has a band gap of 1.5 electron volts. So I'm drawing the band. So this is conduction band. This is valence band. So I just put a slab of gallium arsenide, which is, let's say, 200 angstrom wide. And then I put aluminum arsenide on this side. Okay? Slabs of aluminum arsenide, also 200 angstrom wide. That has a band gap of roughly 2.3 electron volts. And so there is a little square well here. And there'll be square well for holes also, but let's ignore that. And this is a quantum well, and this sort of thing is made routinely now. It was first made in early 80s. This is what molecular beam epitaxy technique does for you. For example, Art Gossard here, you know, grows them every day. And you can see that there'll be roughly something like 0.4 or so electron volt here. So we'll have a confinement potential which should look like this. And this size is roughly, let's say, a few hundred MeV, you know, 100 to 500, small m, okay? MeV is here, millielectron volt. I have faced this problem in giving this talk, okay? Towards the end of the talk, somebody gets very confused. They said, how can you have such high energy physics in condensed matter? Small m, okay? So we are talking about this, chemical potential. So this is the lowest level, I is equal to 1, I is equal to 2. These are typically of the order of 10 to 20 MeV. And you have a chemical potential here. So you have an electron gas here occupying your lowest level. And you can see that it's almost a square well. And very early on when these systems were made, actually in the 70s, it's pretty amazing that you can do experiments by sending electrons through it. And they follow square well energy difference in ordinary textbooks. I mean, it's pretty amazing. You can also have in MOSFET, the situation is a bit different. So in MOSFET, what you have is silicon here, silicon. Then you have a metal here, a metal. And what you want to do is to apply an electric field, so you put an insulator here, okay? Some kind of insulator, so which is silicon dioxide. So that's what the name, metal oxide semiconductor. The most ubiquitous electronic material, silicon MOS, which is the life of your of all your electronic equipment. So what you want to do is apply an electric field. So you just attach a battery like this. Let's say your bulk material is what we call P-type, so you have chemical potential in the bulk like this. Okay? This is conduction band, this is valence band. And if you apply an electric field, what's going to happen? Well, what's going to happen? Bands will bend because you apply an electric field. By the way, people are trying to make these things since the mid-20s. The idea is very old. Langmuir was trying to do that, but because of surface tests, it didn't quite work. It took a long time for it to materialize. Basic idea is extremely simple. So this will bend. This will bend. And now you can see over here, you have a triangular potential well. If I expand that, it's a triangular potential well. And this triangular potential well, so these are, of course, cosine or sine function. Triangular potential well, you all know, I'm sure, that you get Airy functions as solution. And those have been seen also experimentally, the energy difference Airy function. You can take a material like this, and this aluminum arsenide side, you can grade. Instead of having aluminum arsenide, you put gallium arsenide, you put an alloy. So the way I'm going to draw it is this is aluminum arsenide, but you put gallium 1 minus X, aluminum X arsenic, gallium arsenide in the middle, and then again, gallium arsenide, aluminum arsenide, this. Now you can see what would happen if you do that. Since the band gap is different, if you change this X in a continuous fashion, you can actually create a potential which looks like this. Okay, parabolic. This has been done, and people have seen simple harmonic oscillators, you know, completely constant energy separation up to something like 20 subbands, okay, by doing electron scattering experiment absorption. So I have parabolic, I have square, I have triangular. What I do not have is hydrogenic spectrum. That happens in electrons on the surface of liquid helium. When you put electrons on the surface of liquid helium, so this is my helium. This is my helium, very pure system, no disorder at all. And there's an image force, as you know. So if you put an electron here, it's the image force goes as 1 over Z. So electrons get attracted to the image probe, they get bound. Okay? So the potential here looks like this, 1 over Z. So this is one-dimensional hydrogenic spectrum, and again, people have done experiments where they see the one-dimensional hydrogenic spectrum. So I am just giving you these four examples, which kind of suffice to tell you how varied this system is, all of them at one electron level. This is our low-dimensional electron system. Now you can already see what is not a low-dimensional electron system is high-TC material. High-TC materials are layered material. They're highly anisotropic, and what they have is the bandwidth in the plane is much, much larger than the bandwidth in the in axis direction. So there's a large mass anisotropy. For example, cuprates, this mass anisotropy, so M transverse, MC divided by MAB, so MAB, there is a two-dimensional plane, is of the order of 10 to, I think, 200. And you may think 200 is highly anisotropic, it's low dimensional, but it's not because there is still a mass in the Z direction. Here, there is no mass in Z direction because the motion is quantum mechanically frozen at low temperature, okay? So it's very important to understand the difference. You know, then you'll appreciate why the word low dimensional means different things to different people. In this program, we are only talking about low dimensional systems which are where the motion in the third direction is quantum mechanically frozen. For cuprates, you have still have a mass, just the bandwidth is much, much less in the Z direction, much tighter. And so this difference is important to know what is low dimensional from the purpose of the purists and what is low dimensional more loosely. Now, when I talk about localization, which I'll do in a few minutes, then you'll see there is a second possible definition of low dimension because there are other length scales. Here, I'm just talking about only length scale is this quantum confinement, there are other length scales, okay? Let me now see what else I forgot to say. Okay, how do you know that the system is two-dimensional? So I give you a little sample like this and a metal film, and you know that one is two-dimensional, one isn't. But how does one know? Well, the way one knows, and I'm going to jump ahead a little bit, is that you have to do what is called Shubnikov-Dehaas measurements. So you have to measure the resistivity in a weak magnetic field. So apply a weak magnetic field to this two-dimensional layer, and then if you measure the resistivity, I'm just going to plot conductivity, sigma xs as a function of density, then what you'd find is that it shows these oscillations, okay? Periodic oscillations. And these periods correspond to some density. If density is constant for each period, then you immediately know that the system is two-dimensional. This is, in fact, our definition of two-dimensional. Okay? If your experiment shows such constant period, you can call it two-dimensional. And why this is so, I'm going to explain in a minute. It's just basically because of lambda quantization. Each lambda level in a two-dimensional system has exactly the same number of electrons. That's, of course, lambda quantization. That leads to quantum Hall effect. And so either you have to see quantum Hall effect or you have to see this regular period in the oscillation of resistivity. Only then you can call it two-dimensional. Now, I'm going to quickly tell you how you go from two-dimensional to one-dimensional. It's very simple. Remember, some electric field creates your two-dimension. Now, I apply an electric field in some other direction to confine this two-dimensional thing more. Okay, so that is done usually through lithography, and I cannot draw a three-dimensional picture, but you all understand what I'm saying. So, for example, in silicon MOS now, you can take a piece like this and apply an electric field in this direction now. Usually that is done with lithography, and it's very hard to get the strict one-dimensional limit this way. It has been achieved, but it's not as common as a strict two-dimensional limit. And then if you confine in a third direction also, that's called a quantum dot. I'm not going to talk much about them except discuss some of their properties, okay? We need to mention one thing, that all the energy scales and the length scales will change completely because of semiconductor, and that's why millielectron volt is coming in everywhere. So let me just remind you that Bohr radius AB is given by, as you all know, h bar over m square. But in semiconductor, you have to add a dielectric constant there, and this M becomes the effective M effective. And so dielectric constant is typically 10, and this is typically 1 over 10, so you get a factor of 100. So this is 100 A0, roughly, okay? So the Bohr radius here is more like 50 angstroms. Well, in silicon, it's 30 angstrom, in gallium arsenide, 100 angstrom, but it's a large number. And the Rydberg, because of that, which is E squared over 2AB, is now 100 times, so it's 13.6 electron volt divided by 100, so it's more than 100 milliamps. So this sets the scale of physics here. So the length scale is more like 50-100 angstrom. So what does that mean, length scale 50-100 angstrom? It means we can completely ignore all the complexities of lattice. Because the lattice constant is more like 1 or 2 angstrom, we can do theorists' favorite approximation, what's called effective mass approximation. We can assume the electron is just moving in free space with an effective mass and dielectric constant, no lattice whatsoever. That also distinguishes it from models like Hubbard model, where the lattice plays a very crucial role. There is no lattice in any of the, if you go to any of the talks, nobody heard of the lattice side anywhere. The reason is we are talking about continuum theory. It really is like, you know, from a many-body perspective, it's more like QED. I mean, it's just an electron moving around, interacts with other electrons, and all kinds of things happen. So you never talk about lattice at all. Only effect of lattice is changes the dielectric constant from 1 to of the order of 10, changes the mass from 1 to 0.05 or something like that. Okay, this says then that's where those numbers came from. Another thing I want to mention right in the beginning, in talking about what are they, is a revolution took place in early 80s, which is what led to the discovery. By the way, quantum Hall effect was discovered in this system, MOSFET, in 1980. And fractional quantum Hall effect was discovered in gallium arsenide system. Why? Because fractional quantum Hall effect still has not quite been seen in silicon MOSFET because the mobility is not high enough. It's a very dirty system because silicon, you have a lot of disorder at the interface. Okay, so there's a lot of disorder. But in gallium arsenide, what you can do is something called modulation looping. So let me just draw the picture that I had. Okay, so this is the picture. So I have aluminum arsenide here. This is aluminum arsenide. This is gallium arsenide. So what you can do is you can put your, as you know, in semiconductors, semiconductors do not have free carriers, right? They don't have any free electrons or holes because the Fermi level is in the pristine system exactly in the middle of the band gap. So what you have to do is dope them. Here, what you can do is dope them by putting the doping layer very far from the interface. So this is called modulation doping. This was, in fact, people may or may not know this. This was invented also by Horst Stormer, who 5 years after that saw a fractional quantum Hall effect. And if you ask Horst, he may actually be more proud of this discovery than fractional quantum Hall effect, because this goes into every cell phone, as he will tell you. And this modulation doping was a tremendous discovery, because what it did is that impurities are away. So what happens here? So you put a bunch of silicon atom, which releases an electron. Those electrons go here. So as those electrons go here, the band structure changes because there's a dipole. And eventually you get something like this. But the electrons are here. And if this system is completely pure, the impurities are over there. So that means the scattering between electrons and impurities is suppressed by a very large factor, 2k of d. Okay, d is the separation. If d is large and d typically could be 1,000 angstrom, this number could be millions. And so world's fastest transistors are in this modulation doped heterostructure. And in fact, the record mean free path here is 1 millimeter. Well, at 100 millikelvin. Because if you go to high temperature, it all disappears because you have phonons. But at low temperature, it's all impurities. Now, you know, this number, 1 millimeter, so which corresponds to a mobility of 10 to the power 3 times 10 to the power 7, 4 times 10 to the power 7 centimeter squared charge volt second, may not mean much to you unless you work in semiconductor physics. If you take ordinary MOSFET, their room temperature mobility is of the order of 20. Not 20 million, just 20, okay? So this gives you an idea about how much faster these transistors are compared to the ordinary transistors that go into your computer. And now you can see why these are the materials of choice where people are trying to make lots of discovery, because disorder being that weak, you expect interaction effects to be very strong, okay? So that's all I wanted to say about what the system is. Now I'm going to tell you about some of their properties, okay? So in talking about properties, first thing I'll talk about is density of states, because that will then tell us about quantum Hall effect and so on. So if you draw density of states, how many states do you have per unit volume? And let me take the dispersion to be first h bar squared k squared over 2m, then immediately find that in two dimensions it's a constant. In one dimension, in three dimensions it goes as square root of e, so it's constant, square root of e. That's 3D, constant, 2D, and in 1D actually it's singular. It goes as 1 over square root of E in 1D. Okay? So since density of state is a fundamental quantity in everything we do in solid state physics, you can see there'll be substantial difference between 2D and 3D. Now what about interaction? That's another important issue here. All the interaction I'll be talking about here is 1 over R interaction, true Coulomb interaction in 3D. Because I'm talking about a true 3D structure where we have applied various confinement potentials to quantize the system. So this is not what is called Coulomb gas in statistical mechanics. This is a true true Coulomb interaction where R is a 3D distance. Okay? So now if you take the 2D Fourier transform, 3D Coulomb interaction, what you get is, of course, we all know that we get 1 over Q squared in 3D, 1 over Q in 2D, and log Q in 1D. So that all the differences that arise between 3D system and low dimensional systems, all of them are arising from fundamentally from these two objects. Okay, everything, you have to do a lot of calculations, but these are the two differences. Everything else is, you know, what you build on. This is the main difference. Okay, now one difference I can talk about right now, it's simple and it's kind of shows you how things differ. Let's talk about what we call plasmon, the collective mode of an electron gas. It's a very good thing to talk about to show the distinction. Okay, so plasmon is just a quantized plasma oscillation. If I take an electron gas, it's the same plasma oscillation they have in plasma physics. If I take an electron gas, if I disturb it a little bit, there is a restoring force because of Coulomb interaction, because Coulomb interaction is long-ranged, and there is an oscillation, self-sustaining oscillation. And you all know that in 3D, the classical plasma frequency is 4 pi n e squared divided by m. Just follows from continuity equation. It's very easy to derive where it comes from. Okay, I'm not going to, it's trivial. What would happen in 2D? Well, we can see what would happen in 2D by just, in a 2D, there is really no long wavelength restoring force. Okay, so it will be, so this is 3D. 2D is actually 2 pi n e squared divided by m q. So it goes a square root of q, where q is the momentum or the wave vector. And in 1D, it goes as q log q square root. So the plasma oscillation in, as a function of q is basically constant in 3D, and it looks like this. And it's very easy to see theoretically where it's coming from. All you need to consider are these diagrams, because we can calculate quantum correction to that. So plasma oscillation is given by just the proper vertex, proper polarizability. So it's just given by this equal to V times this, interaction type, Coulomb interaction times this is equal to 1. This is the plasmon formula. This gives the self-sustaining oscillation. Basically what it says is that the reducible vertex, you know, these diagrams must give you an instability, because you're looking at interaction between electrons. All the other electrons are trying to screen the interaction, and if the screening gives you a singularity at 0, then the effective interaction is infinite, even when you didn't have anything. So that's really the plasmon. And this is very easy to show that it follows from causality that it must go as this form. And once you combine this with this, where is my Fourier transform Coulomb interaction, you immediately get this formula. And again, this 2D plasmon and 1D plasmon both have been seen in semiconductor systems. People do Raman spectroscopy, people do electron scattering, and that's exactly what comes out. And this is actually one way of seeing that the system is 2D. Now, I should put a caveat there, because somebody would ask me, you know, real interaction is actually much more complicated than this. Why? Because of a metal gate here, for example. Okay, so what would the metal gate do? Suppose the metal gate was right here. It's a not very simple electrostatics problem that you can solve by conformal mapping. And what basically happens is that this metal piece, because it's infinite conductivity material, is going to actually change the electron-electron interaction. And so what happens is that you'll get a factor which is cotangent hyperbolic QD plus 1 coming in the denominator, just coming from this metal screen effect. So actually at very long wavelength, even this will change into linear. And even that, you know, you get quantitative agreement with experiment when you do these measurements. Now, people have done much more than this. My friend Aaron Pinczuk at Bell Lab, well, when he was at Bell Labs, when Bell Labs existed, did measurements on what we call super lattice. So you can take a bunch of these layers and put them together. So all I'm talking about is you just take a bunch of these quantum wells and put them together. Very easy to do. It's a multi-layer structure. And then you can ask, well, what will be the plasmons here? Because Coulomb interaction is long range, so a layer here will be coupled to a layer there through Coulomb interaction, even if I don't have any hopping of electrons. And you can calculate the what the plasmon dispersion relation would look like. And you can see that if this thing is periodic, let me call this period D, then you'll have plasmon band. Because now you'll have a block Floquet theorem in this direction. The structure is periodic. So the plasmon should show periodicity, you know, in this D, and you have plasmon band. And this concept was actually verified in this system. So the plasmon band, so let's say that I'm talking in two-dimensional Q, omega, it basically looks like, and you have plasmon throughout this range, and so the plasmon frequency goes as this two-dimensional plasma frequency, omega P2D, that I wrote down there, times a form factor, which goes as sine hyperbolic QD divided by cosine hyperbolic QD minus cosine KZA. Now, what does this thing come from? This thing comes from adding the Coulomb interaction over this geometric series. Okay?
Let me just ask, yes. I'm starting your 2D formula. So
yes.
If I'm degenerate in the 2D direction, then
right.
Little n, which is the number of free unit area, is just going to go like Q squared.
No, this n is a constant, because this is whatever number of electrons you have put in there.
I understand. I'm just asking, so there's your Q is your transverse wavelength.
That's correct.
Right, so what I'm asking is,
right.
To say it goes like proportionality of Q, you're saying that the little n, the number density, mm-hmm. doesn't know about the wave number.
That's correct, absolutely. They're independent quantities.
And
yes.
That is true? Or
that
not?
Is true, because what they do experimentally, so you may ask, how do they create the wave vector? There are two ways of creating. They can put a grating to create a wave vector to do optical experiments, or they can just do Raman scattering, just like Compton scattering, and change the wavelength of light or change the angle. It's quite clever what they do. Okay. So they send light in.
So you're not degenerate in the plane?
No. Okay. Meaning by degenerate, you mean quantum degeneracy? No, I'm degenerate in the plane. I don't understand what this has got to be degenerate. I'm missing something. You mean there'll be higher order corrections to that? Is that what you're asking?
No, I'm asking about your little n.
Little n just the density, number of electrons per square centimeter.
Right. And I'm
right.
saying that at some number density,
right?
Right. That sets a Fermi energy.
Correct. Correct.
In the plane.
Correct. It is.
So n and Q are related.
N and EF are related. Q is a free wave vector of your plasma. Okay, now I understand your question.
Sorry.
Yes.
Gotcha.
Right.
Okay.
KF and N are related, but not Q. Q is the probe wave vector.
Got it.
And they change the direction of light to change that. These are very, you know, clever experiments. Yeah. Yeah. Maybe I wasn't clear. So, and here the band, you can see that this is KZ is equal to Q over D. And this is KZ is equal to zero. So KZ is the probe wave vector in Z direction. Now this is Z. This may be more complicated than, it's actually much simpler than it looks. So what is KZ is equal to zero means? Means you're looking at very long wavelength in this direction. If you look at very long wavelength in this direction, system doesn't know it's layered. You should get a three-dimensional plasma frequency, and that's exactly what you get. You get exactly the three-dimensional formula. It comes out of here if you do the expansion right. Because KZA zero, this is one, and you have to go to the next order term, and then it drops out, it becomes a constant. And there are infinite number of modes here. They're all linear modes. They're all linear modes. So it's basically, this is an optical plasmon, and these are all acoustic plasmons. So this is exactly what you have for ordinary phonons. If you have a basis, you can have acoustic phonons and optical phonons. Here you have acoustic plasmon and optical plasmons. And all these modes have been seen, and people have put these things randomly. Then you see plasmon localization. That has been seen. You can put these things in a quasi-periodic structure, in a Fibonacci sequence. Then you see the Cantor set. Well, you know, you have to imagine it a little bit. You have to do some theory because there is disorder. But the Cantor set has been seen. So this is a nice tool to do things that you cannot do in ordinary 1D system, because sometimes these things are called artificial structures. You can create what you want to do and then test whether it works. Okay, so that's what I wanted to say about general properties. Let me now talk about localization, which is a very important subject. Okay, so let me erase everything, talk about localization, because localization is a totally different story. And in fact, some of the early interest in two-dimensional system was because of localization. Okay. So what is it that I want to talk about localization? Okay, so I have to start by talking about something which will sound completely disconnected with what I was saying so far. There's a scaling theory of localization, okay? And hopefully in less than 5 minutes, we'll see the connection with low-dimensional system. So in scaling theory of localization, what we imagine is that you have a beta function which is a function of some conductance at some scale L, and this is, so G is, so I have a sample of linear size L, and has some conductance G, and what you want to do is to build your bulk sample by putting many of these things together. And it was realized in late 70s, originally due to Paulus and Anderson's work on the one hand, and Wegener's work based on sigma model on the other hand, and then a lot of people contributed afterwards, that this is a very powerful way of looking at localization. And you can now take two different approaches, they're equivalent, but in people who are not field theorists, people who are doing low dimensional physics, condensed matter physics, they said, well, I can actually calculate this beta function directly numerically. And then immediately realized that there is this diagram, which actually was originally written down by Jim Langer, who is not here, but he never really explored it. There is a diagram called maximally crossed diagram, where you have an impurity and many, many, many electron lines going through that. If you calculate this diagram, in three dimensions, nothing much happens. You have a correction. But if you calculate in two dimensions, then this beta function immediately has this form. So beta goes as, so in two dimensions, so I have d minus 2 here. So this is my epsilon. So this is an epsilon expansion. Then the next term, order 1 over g. The sign is minus. That's very important. What that basically means that in two dimensions, you don't have a metal. Because if you integrate this thing, because of this minus sign, the conductance, the bulk conductance as L goes to infinity will basically go to, you know, it will have this correction which will grow as log L over some scale. So that means in 2D there is no metal. This will say in 2D, no metal. Okay. Now what happens in 1D? What happens in 3D first? So in 3D, it's okay because in 3D you have you have a number here, 1, and then you have order 1 over g. So in 3D, you'd say, okay, when the conductance is very small, I'll have a transition because this term is becoming comparable to the leading term. But until that, nothing would happen. So let me draw what the beta function looks like for three dimensions. So this is, I'm talking about so-called generic ensemble, the orthogonal ensemble. So beta functions look like this as a function of g. In 2D, it would look like this. Well, it will cross, actually. In 1D, it would look like this. And 3D, actually, it will cross and look like this. And this is all coming from the fact that the first term comes with a minus sign. So that means in 3D, you have a true metal insular transition. So this is a metal insular transition. So as you make the system dirtier and dirtier, eventually the system will go from a metal to an insulator. But in two dimensions, what you're finding is that no matter how pure your system is, it's always an insulator, albeit logarithmically. So the localization length, if you want to talk about it, is very, very large. So you can write the localization length. So localization length in 2G will go as e to the power g. So if G is large, it's very large. It's maybe much larger than the system size, so it doesn't make any sense to talk about localization. But strictly speaking, thermodynamic limit, the system is always localized. Now you can see that in this discussion, I did not use quantum confinement anywhere. The whole concept of what I was talking about before in low-dimensional system, this would be quantum confined, this argument doesn't use that at all. It's just a scaling idea. It just depends on length scale. So clearly, this argument should be valid whenever the system size is smaller than some length scale, but that length scale doesn't have to be quantum length. And it took physicists something like 5-6 years to understand what that length is, and that length is called Paulus length, or often called L5. Basically, what it is a quantum interference phenomena. So the system must know that it's low dimensional from the perspective of interference. That means this L5, I'm going to define this L5, whatever this phase coherence length is, must be larger than system size. If L5 is larger than system size, so let's say you have a thin metal film, okay, and the thickness of the metal film is smaller than L5, even if you have 1,000 subbands occupied, it doesn't matter. The system is low-dimensional, two-dimensional from a localization perspective. It's not two-dimensional from the perspective of quantum Hall effect, but it's two-dimensional from the perspective of localization. So what is the L5? L5 is how far the electron diffuses before it has an inelastic collision. So L5 goes as square root of L elastic times L inelastic. And alienelastic grows as some function of alienelastic goes as some function T to the power minus P. Because as you lower temperature, the inelastic scattering is suppressed, so L5 keeps on growing. And so what this is basically saying, that if you take any metal film, any two metal film, semiconductor film, as long as the film, if you keep on lowering temperature, you'll eventually enter this regime because this alpha is going to be very large. And so for localization, this is a confusing point, for localization purpose, metal films are two-dimensional. All of mesoscopic phenomena is actually based on ideas like this, where quantum interference effects are important. So if you go to a talk, random talk here, if it's on mesoscopics, you'll find people are talking about metal films or metal systems. But if they're talking about anything else, they're talking about semiconductor. Because all mesoscopic phenomena basically is based on this situation where quantum interference effects are two-dimensional, and those are very important and they all arise from this. Now, since I wrote down the beta function and there are film theorists in the audience, I should tell you that that's not the complete story, and that will take me to the next thing. And this is old, but there are still questions. So the beta function, there are three ensembles, and you can write them down. D minus 2 order 1 over G is the so-called orthogonal ensemble. So orthogonal ensemble is a generic situation where you have no magnetic field, no spin orbit coupling, all the symmetries are obeyed. Then you have unitary ensemble. So unitary ensemble is where you apply a magnetic field. So here, B is weak.
You're talking about the ensemble of the random...
Right, that's, yeah. Disorder. I'm talking only about the disorder ensemble. That's absolutely correct. So that's D minus 2 minus order 1 over G square. Okay? And then there is one called symplectic, and physically there, so symplectic. So this one has spin orbit coupling. So they are actually D minus 2 plus order 1 over G. Okay? So this all comes from the sigma model, and I'm going to discuss that. But if you look at it, what you see is that in two dimension, D minus 2 is 0. Two dimension, this is the only ensemble that has a metal insert transition because this sign is plus. Even when you have a magnetic field, what this is saying, when you have a magnetic field, the localization length is very large. It goes as e to the power g square. Okay, very large. But you still have localization. Okay? This is a very important point. Because if this were the whole truth, we'll never have quantum Hall effect. Because for quantum Hall effect, you need extended states. So I want to emphasize that this is still an open question. You know, a lot of people have worked on it. And the easiest way out, which is not a theory, but a scenario, is to say, well, once you have strong magnetic field and you have lambda quantization, you have two quantities defining your problem, sigma xx and sigma xy. So you cannot have this one parameter scaling theory anymore, because this was, remember, just dependence on GL. Now you need at least two parameters. And if you have two parameters, then the problem is more complicated. But the unfortunate thing is that using these two parameters, you can put in by hand what you need. You need a topological term, a theta term. But I don't know of any microscopic model from which one can derive this and show that that happens. But this is still an unsolved problem. A second unsolved problem is, how do you include interaction in this? If you have to do... Okay, let's first talk about including interaction here in the fractional quantum Hall effect. Very difficult. And I don't think there is even a scenario for that. And it's such a hard problem that people have stopped worrying about it. And this is a place where I think mathematically powerful field theories, meaning string theories, could make contribution. This is a completely open problem that we do not know how to modify the sigma model in the presence of interaction. But forget about strong magnetic field. That is an open question even in this ensemble. Suppose I ask you the question, this is all just one electron disorder, no interaction at all. Suppose I have interaction and disorder both. Well, this theory has to be modified because the nice sigma model doesn't apply anymore. What happens? We do not know. Okay. Most people believe that the basic picture doesn't change, but there are people let me not name them since I disagree with them, who believe because I may say something disparaging, who believe that there is a true metal insular transition in two dimension, meaning somehow this sign changes if you want to have this picture. And so even in the simple case of orthogonal ensemble, we do not know what happens when you add interaction to the problem. Okay? So let me now go to quantum Hall, because I want to explain why quantum Hall requires the existence of extended state. And then I may not go to graphene. But since almost all the talks in our program are graphene, that's okay. Well, since I may not get to graphene, graphene is all these things when the dispersion is e to the power v h bar k, okay? Linear dispersion, and when the system looks like this, and the Hamiltonian is this rather than the standard P square over 2m Hamiltonian, okay? So all the things I told you, that's why there's so many papers on graphene. You can open Ashcroft and Marmon, and just change every chapter to this, and you got a paper. You got several papers, and I'm not exaggerating at all. You know, I'd say I'll classify 80% of graphene papers, including several of my own of that category, because you have to do that first. Somebody has to do that first, you know, because it's not in the literature. And all the, you can see the density of states will immediately change once you have this, right? Density of states for this in 2D, density of states will go as square root of it. It will vanish linearly in 2D. And so it's not constant anymore. So the density of states is E. Plasma dispersion still remains the same because Coulomb interaction doesn't change. So I don't think I'll get to graphene. So I'm just telling you what the basic issue in graphene is. There are then many other things. So let me talk about quantum Hall effect, which certainly is intellectually one of the most important issues, very hotly discussed in this program. So I told you that the density of state is constant in 2D, right? That's some constant density of state up to some Fermi energy. Okay. Now suppose you have a strong magnetic field, then you can immediately show that this will break into a bunch of delta functions at the non-interacting level. So the density of states in a strong magnetic field is going to be some constant, which I'm going to write down in a second, delta E minus En, where En is just the Landau level energy. So these are just the Landau level energy. So n is equal to 0, 1, 2, 3, so on. What is C? C is actually a macroscopic number. It's 1 over 2 pi L squared, where L is the magnetic length. L is CH bar divided by EB. And if I remember it right, this is about 2.4 times 10 to the power 10 centimeter square per Tesla. So what that means is that when you apply a magnetic field, the system breaks up in the absence of disorder in a completely singular manner. These are delta function density of states. Each of these delta function contains that many electrons. So if you had just 2.4 times 10 to the power 10 electrons, and you applied one Tesla field, all of them will be occupying the lowest Landau level. Now, this is, of course, a very singular situation because it's an almost infinite degeneracy, in fact, in the thermodynamic limit, it is infinite degeneracy. All these electrons are exactly the same energy level, so everything will split it. So in reality, what you find is that this thing will broaden because of disorder and maybe because of other things too, and you'll have, but the basic structure will remain. Now, what happens is that if I now draw, so let me try to draw the Hall effect in a situation like this. Classical Hall effect just goes linearly in B. Okay, proportional to B. So now let me try to draw what we have there. So what would happen is that the real Hall effect shows this part. So this corresponds to, let me use a different color, this corresponds to this region, the region in between Landau levels. So this, then this, then this. And what is going from one of these, so I'll draw the picture here to make it clear. So let me draw the Landau levels very separately. Okay, and let's say there is some, and I have some extended state in the middle, and this is all localized. This is all localized. So this region corresponds to this. And this region where, again you have another region like this, this corresponds to this. And where they're making a transition from one to other, that corresponds to this. So you have quantum phase transition from plateaus. These are different quantum Hall plateaus. I'm drawing rho xy. So you have quantum Hall plateau transition from one plateau to another as the system goes through the middle of the Landau level. And it's absolutely clear that to get these quantization, you must have extended states of the middle, at least in the center of the Landau level, you must have extended states. Okay? There is just no way to explain the quantization of the plateau unless you have extended states, true extended state in the middle of the Landau level. Now, the sigma model-based theory, all the field theory tells you that in two-dimensional, all states are localized. It doesn't matter whether you have a magnetic field or not. So what is missing here? What is missing in this theory is that when people talk about magnetic field here, they're not talking about a lambda quantized situation. The sigma model doesn't take into account the fact that you have true quantization of your levels. Okay? So this theory directly doesn't apply there, and we fully know now that there is this plateau transition, and this is still kind of an open question, I would say. We know what the critical exponent of these plateaus are, of this transition is. All the critical exponents are known from numerical work and from experiment, but there is no theory to understand it, and there is a very famous paper in which Matthew Fisher is a co-author, where they made a valiant effort with Greenstein and I guess Ludwig and Shankar, where they made a very valiant effort to understand this. It's a nuclear physics, a lot of equations, a lot of field theory, and the paper ends literally with this sentence: in spite of all this work, we still cannot access the strong coupling point. Okay, which is still the center of the subject. Okay, that you can write down various things, but this strong coupling point, we have no theory, and probably we didn't need different field theory to explain it. I mean, and this is an open question again, which connects somehow with the, you know, the string and the field theory community. Now I have to talk about five half. So let me tell you one very important aspect of two dimensions that we have not discussed at all. That is, two dimension is very special for another reason. Two dimension allows anions. And Chetan gave a very nice talk on this the other day, but I'm just going to give a small summary. So we all know, and this will be probably pretty trivial for most people. So if I have a sphere, I have a particle here, I take another particle around it, around the sphere, I can this path can be made to vanish continuously. So in three dimension, we all know that exchange and permutation are equivalent, and then once you also accept, I mean, I'm not going to talk about higher dimensional representation of permutation group, you know, where you have parastatistics and so on, because they don't occur in nature. We only have symmetrization principles, so only fermions or bosons. Nothing else is allowed in three dimension. And that's because, you know, there is no knot. Okay, you can just make the path and make it continuously vanish. Two dimension is different. If I have a particle here and I move another particle around it, there is no way to make this path vanish without going through the singularity. I mean, it's obvious. So that means in two dimension you have knots in the world line, and the actual statistics is braiding. Weight statistics, not permutation. So permutation group doesn't play any role here, but it's pretty amazing, you know, at least to me, appears very amazing that this was realized only in 1977. If you think about it, this could have been realized in 1930. I mean, there's no reason for this. I mean, I do not know the history of topology, but people must have known about braiding by that time, because this is something I teach even undergraduates now, you know. But it was realized only in 1977, and it tells you that, you know, even in theory, there is hope. Not all easy things are done, you know. I tell my students, all easy things are done, you know. That's why I'm not famous. But some easy things were not done just before my time. Just before my time, okay? You know, just before my time, they're not done. It's really amazing if you think about it, that it took... So this brain study, see, what it immediately means that you have a wave function, and you, so if you have two, you know, R1 and R2, and you change it to R2 and R1, there could be a phase, there could be a general phase here, which was, you know, really Frank Wilczek showed its importance, and so these are called anions, that you can pick up an extra phase just through the exchange. And now, just because something is allowed doesn't mean it occurs in nature. And this is how it was for a long time, but we now know that Laughlin quasi-particles in two dimension are anions. There is just no doubt about it. Although we have not directly seen this phase, phase is very difficult to see, right? But Laughlin would argue, and I tend to agree with him, that the very fact that those objects are fractionally charged, you have no escape. There must be anionic phase in there. So one can say, maybe with a little caveat, that anions have been seen in two dimensions. This can happen only in two dimensions. It cannot happen in higher dimensions, because only in two dimensions you have knots, non-trivial knots in the world line, and you have to work with Bray statistics. But then in 1988, a Frolich realized something which is, you know, in that context even more interesting. He realized that if you somehow have a degenerate ground state of these quasi-particles, then when you exchange them, you can pick up a matrix. So psi could go into psi, AB, and you come back, there could be a matrix in there if the subspace is degenerate. That's obvious, right? If the subspace is degenerate, you come back, You don't have to come back to exactly the same state. You can come back in some other part of your degenerate manifold. So that means that this anionic statistics doesn't even have to be abelian. It can be non-abelian. Again, it was a mathematical curiosity until we realized that this 5-half fractional quantum Hall state may be a realization of this sort of non-abelian anions. And if they are, and that's a big if, then we can do topological quantum computation and many other things which are very interesting. This is a very active area of research. In Q Station, we have workshops every 6 months, literally just to discuss this point. Because again, we know that just because something is mathematically allowed doesn't mean they have to occur in nature. But many of us working in the subject believe, I think all of us, minus Jayanendra, believe that these are non-abelian 5-half state. But, you know, without the experiment, one can still question whether this really exists or not. Do I have 5 more minutes because you came 5 minutes late? Why are people laughing? It's a statement of fact. Okay, so last 5 minutes I have to spend on graphene. Since almost all the talks in our, the first talk here I attended, I looked around to see how many people are in the room who were at the 1998 Quantum Hall program. We had a 5-month program right after David came here in 1998, which I actually ran. And that's very similar to this 2D program now, and although it was called Quantum Hall. And I saw only myself and then Rudolf Morf walked in. Just 2 out of 30 in the room were at that 1998 program. That made me feel very good. You know, David's definition of a very vital subject is everybody's young, okay? And my definition of young is younger than me. And other than Rudolf, everybody in the room was younger than me, and many were very young. And I was very happy about that until I realized that most of these people are doing graphene, you know? Quantum Hall is still being done by people who are very old. It's a strange psychology. You know, Quantum Hall, since it's a very mature subject, Hamiltonian is extremely well defined. Its entry price is very high. You cannot, in condensed matter, the standard trick is to make up your Hamiltonian and work on it. You know, HiTC has been very successful in this mode. I'm not being facetious, you know, because people cannot agree on the Hamiltonian, then you can do whatever you want, you know. Sometimes that leads to good things. But in our case, the Hamiltonian is extremely well defined. I already told you what it is. And there's tremendous experimental evidence. Experiment constrains us completely that the interaction is 1 over Q. You know, density of states is constant. You know, so you can't make up a Hamiltonian where I'm going to use Hubbard model when the interaction is constant in Q space, okay? You can do that, but you will not be able to publish them if they come to me, because I say, well, this is not two-dimensional system. So graphene, on the other hand, being a new subject, is, you know, amazing. So let me just tell you one amazing thing about graphene. I heard it, but I looked it up. In 2004, there were 2 papers on the archive. In 2005, there were like 7. 2006, 130 or something like that. 2007, 500. 2008, 700. And 2009, I think, maybe 1,000 papers, okay? It's an amazing, astonishing increase. So what is the big deal? Why are people interested in graphene? First, ultimate 2D system. It literally is one layer, one monolayer of carbon atoms arranged in a honeycomb. Okay? This is the whole system. Everything follows from this. One monolayer of carbon atoms arranged in a honeycomb. That's graphene. Okay? It's also nothing other than if you take a nanotube, on which a lot of work has been done, a nanotube is a graphene rolled up like this. Okay? So if you unroll a nanotube, that's graphene. Literally, okay? People thought that can't be done, but has been done, and the band structure of this was done in 1948. So you can tell that the basic physics of it, you know, that's before QED. This is around QED. Basic physics of it is very simple, and this band structure is what you all use, okay? That band structure, and I don't have time to discuss the band structure, but obviously it's not, it's just a tight binding band structure. The most important thing in this band structure is that there are 2 inequivalent sides, A and B. I can try to draw it, but I'll screw it up. No, that's going to take 5 minutes to draw, okay? But there are 2 inequivalent sides, A and B. So what that basically means is this. It's very important. This is the only thing one needs to know about graphene. Electrons that are hopping on A sites always stay on the A site. Electrons that are hopping on B sites always stay on B site. You cannot have hopping from A site to B site. Okay? That's called inter-valley scattering, and that's not allowed. That leads to the chirality. That means electrons that are moving in A always move on A, electrons that are moving on B always move on B, and it just so happens that if you take this tight binding model on honeycomb lattice, you immediately get a Hamiltonian whose dispersion is this. There is no, I mean, you do not have to do any filter, anything. You just, it's a literally a graduate level quantum mechanical problem. You do the tight binding theory on a honeycomb lattice, you get this dispersion, linear, and one branch is A, one branch is B, no scattering allowed between this, at least unless the symmetry is broken. And this is why graphene is called chiral. Sometimes these A and B things are called valleys. You know, you hear the word valley. Sometimes it's called pseudo-spin. They're all the same thing. Basically, there is an additional quantum index coming from these inequivalent sites, which give rise to this fact that you have two branches, and their dispersion, amazing, is the Masters-Dirac equation. Pretty amazing thing, chiral. So much of the theoretical interest or interest in graphene has come from the fact that it has this massless Dirac equation spectrum, and people even talk about doing quantum electrodynamics on a pencil tip, but there are problems. When you do QED, when you're talking about electrons and photons interacting in free space, you do not have impurities usually. Here, our environment is filled with impurities. So when you have a graphene sample, you have lots of impurities. So this pristine picture, they have to be modified by impurities, which are very strong perturbation, and it's a very active area of research, what those impurities do, and there are various models and there are various experiments, but the basic physics is just this, and I have used exactly my extra 5 minutes. And although I can talk about graphene a lot, I'll stop here. Okay.
Okay, how about questions from outside the program? Formulating a question.
Well, I have a question. Okay, so if you ignore the impurities,
yes.
You take this ideal sample.
Yes.
It's described by basically a two-dimensional relativistic electron.
Exactly. Massless.
Massless.
Correct.
So that seems pretty simple.
Yes.
So would there still be a lot of interest or work on this if that
was... Well, that was my reaction when I first heard about this thing. I said this is trivial first year, book. But the thing is that there are, for example, Klein tunneling. There are things there that you do not see in nuclear physics. Some of those things have been seen. So the interest comes from the fact that you really have this system, and this system may lead to some of the things like Klein tunneling, which if you take Dirac equation, theoretically it's not something very, very difficult, but seeing it, and it has been seen. So there are issues which are somewhat interesting from that. This is not a field theory because, it's a weak coupling system. So since you asked the question, so graphene, if you dope it now, you can put many electrons here, okay? By applying a gate, you can put many electrons there. But the coupling constant, the fine structure constant, is of the order of 0.8. Okay. Now you may say, well, that doesn't sound that small because in QED it's 1 over 137, but the system I was telling you about before, this alpha could be as large as 50. Okay. Alpha there varies from 0.5 to 50 in the 2D system. So we have a lot of experience in doing many-body theory systems like that. In graphene, seeing many-body effects is very hard because the coupling constant is small.
What's the definition of alpha here?
Well, it's the same as in ordinary electron gas, potential energy divided by kinetic energy. Okay. But here it's a constant. It turns out to be exactly, it's exactly 1 over kappa Vf, basically.
Okay.
Because of this linear dispersion. Okay, so that's why it's constant. It doesn't depend on density. Normally, you'd expect it to depend on density, but here it's constant. Am I answering your question? I mean, because it's linear. This dispersion is linear. Because it drops out. Both kinetic energy and potential energy go exactly the same way. Both go as 1 over density, square root of density.
So in this sense, it plays the role of fine structure constant.
It is exactly fine structure constant. The fine structure constant is much larger. That's all. As was commented, this is just Dirac theory. You expect fine structure constant to be there. But it's small by solid state physics standard. And we have looked into it and we calculate how much the velocity will be normalized by things, but it's just a few percent, not a big deal. I would say that from my perspective, most of the interest is trying to understand what charge impurities do, and that's pretty non-trivial, because there we have no guide from field theory, And for example, one thing that I believe goes on, but it's a controversial subject, you have these charge impurities, and since Coulomb interaction is long-range, they form puddles. So close to the Dirac point, Okay? What you have is that you have an impurity here. So if I draw the picture in real space, the system looks like this. So you have impurities moving the Dirac point from spatially. So especially in homogeneous system. So if I draw the chemical potential through here, here I have holes, here I have holes, here I have electrons, somewhere else I may have electrons. So the system breaks up into these little puddles. And if that is the case, that means you'll completely lose the physics of Dirac point because of this charge impurity. So these puddles, there's some experimental evidence of these puddles. You can directly go and look for them. These puddles have been seen, and they, of course, have implications for transport. We calculate those things. So it's not even clear that Dirac point physics can be accessed, because once you go to low energy, other physics comes in. You know, that's the beauty or the crumminess of solid-state physics, that you have to take them into account. And there's a lot of interest in understanding this sort of picture, whether that's operational or not.
I have a comment on the Rydberg in a semiconductor.
Please.
Because in going from the Bohr radius to the Rydberg, the dielectric constant enters a second time in the denominator.
That's correct.
So, but that then puts the Rydberg to a much lower number than the one you quoted. So it isn't 100 milliEV, it's 10 milliEV.
Right, you're absolutely right. It's 10 milliElectron volt. I just did not want to complicate things. In real calculation, you don't use any of those things. You're absolutely correct. The real Rydberg is not 100 milliElectron volt. It's much lower. You're absolutely correct.
It's 6 milliElectron.
Absolutely correct. It's much lower than that. And the energy scale is really a few milliElectron volts, not a few tens milliElectron volts. You're absolutely correct. Yeah.
Okay, that's fine. Thank you again.